Good morning. Let's get serious. I'm depressed. It's not you. It's not you. I'm depressed over Wikipedia. I'm depressed over MySpace and Facebook, and really depressed over YouTube. Let me tell you why. My name is Michael Anderson. I work at the University of Texas System Telecampus. We're the online group within the UT system, and we build learning environments, and we teach faculty how to take their courses up online. I'm not talking about just taking their Word documents that they pass out in class and throwing those up on a website. I'm talking about really redesigning their courses to make them really work in a digital environment. We help them develop content, and we work a lot on the idea of interaction, student-to-content interaction, interactions among students, and particularly interaction between the students and the faculty. And I go home every night, and I feel kind of smug and cool because I'm helping people learn. And I'm helping people learn who could not get there to a campus geographically and who have lives that take them from 9 to 5 where they have to work, and they've got families at night and soccer games and PTA meetings. And these people are furthering their education via online courses. And I feel good about that. And then not too long ago, I saw a video on YouTube. Video might be a little stretch. It's really more like a series of PowerPoint slides with some music behind it. And it had a little interesting fact in there. It said MySpace was now the 10th largest country, and it just passed Japan. I said, So those 20 students or those 200 students that we were helping, we felt real good about, and we were up to 10,000 students after 10 years, weren't even scratching the surface, weren't even making a difference. And then I was on Wikipedia, and I was looking up Moore's Law as applied to information. I saw a little thing on there, and it said, the amount of technical knowledge is doubling every 3 years. That means that when a student starts in college, by the time they're a junior, half of what they have learned in the past few years is out of date. So I realized that the content was not solving the problem. And the Wikipedia article went on to project that within three years, the amount of technical information was going to be doubling every 72 hours. There is no way that we could keep up with that. And so I got depressed. Then I started thinking about video games. Now I'm not talking about Pong. I used to play Pong. Pong came out when I was a teenager. And I'm not even talking about arcade games. I don't know how many hundreds of dollars I spent with my kids, you know, beating the last level in X-Men or Simpsons or even Jurassic Park. And I'm not talking about video games that you played on, and they were cool video games like GoldenEye and Half-Life, really immersive games on a PC. I'm talking about multiplayer online games. I'm talking about Halo 3 on Xbox Live. I'm talking about console, even PC games that are things like Counter-Strike with the audio enabled. Talking about World of Warcraft and even to some extent Second Life. And that kind of got me interested again. Imagine this. Imagine that instead of sitting in a classroom and you're one of 500 students in that seat out there and learning about history, instead you are inside a game and you are actually living it. And you are making those decisions. And you're seeing the ramifications of it. And instead of taking a 100-item multiple choice test that you got an hour to finish, you leveled up. And instead of standing outside your instructor's door, waiting to ask a question about something you didn't understand in the lecture, you could get online and you could ask people who were in that game as well for help. And it didn't always come back to the classroom and the instructor doing everything as the fount of knowledge. Imagine that we had a game that would teach people how to not start wars instead of learning about battles. That's what I'm talking about. And that's what this panel is here today to talk about. Whether or not video games can and should replace college. To my right here is Karen Lynn. Karen's a student at Westwood High School here in Austin. The way she got this gig is she beat my butt at Mario. In fact, more importantly, she beat my son's butt at Mario, and he thinks he's pretty cool. To her right is Aliza Gold. Aliza is the coordinator for the Digital Media Collaboratory over at UT Austin, associated there. She's worked in serious game development and developed some simulations for U.S. Army medics. And at the far end, and the reason he's at the far end is so that he can't throw things, or if he does, he's going to have to go through Aliza and Karen to get to me, is Mike McShaffrey. Mike is a commercial game developer. He started at Origin back in 1990 and developed Ultima, and then Ultima Online, and most recently worked on Thief. So he's going to bring this perspective of commercial game development. In fact, we had an interesting argument where I was arguing to replace college courses with video games, and he was arguing, well, no, I don't know if you really know what you're talking about, and he's got a good point. So I'm going to start up first with Karen, and she's going to tell you a little bit about what she sees of the value of video games, because if I can't convince her that video games should replace college, we might as well go home. Karen?
I think that video games could offer a new opportunity to learn, because I know that I've been taking AP classes since my sophomore year, and it's like 30 pages of reading every night, and it's like really small print. And if anyone offered me an opportunity to play a game or anything, just not to read, I think that, you know, I would take it. I mean, I like learning and it's like interesting, but I definitely would take another way to learn. It's just definitely another way.
Aliza?
Okay. Like, I also know, like, video games are really addicting, and I think it would make me want to learn. I know that I play tennis, and my club team, we made it to regionals. You know, we had played for a couple months. We won city. We won our little central region, and we were playing for state. And that Tuesday, Halo 2 came out. And so we were like, you know, we'll bring it just in case, you know, we'll play in our free time. And it turned into, we practice for 30 minutes, and then we just, you know, pull out the game and we play. And then at night when our coach went to his cabin, we, like, snuck over and we, like, played till, like, 4 in the morning, even though we had, like, a 7 a.m. match. And even though we didn't do as well, considering we didn't practice as much, it was, like, fulfilling since we ended up beating the game and we had – and Halo 2 had the new, like, multiplayer instead of compared to the first one, and so – that was.
So you gave up tennis for video games. Well, there's a start there.
Okay. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Aliza. And I haven't only made games for Army medics. I also worked on a design funded by the National Science Foundation to help teach middle school students how to use the scientific method. Also produced a game called Nero with undergraduate volunteers where they took an artificial intelligence technique that had been developed by a PhD student and by themselves figured out how to make it work in a commercial game engine in real time. And they ended up going on to win an award at the Independent Games Festival at the Game Developers Conference. And then recently, NASA actually put out a request for proposals for studios or universities to create a massively multiplayer online game to teach students scientific and math skills and interest them in space missions. So people are starting to wake up to the power of games to teach and to help people learn. But one thing I think is interesting about this topic is that we probably wouldn't be talking about it if school was really working well, right? But it doesn't seem to be. Right now in Texas, there's about a 30% dropout rate from high school. which is pretty horrifying. And out of 100 kids who start high school nationally, only about 18 end up graduating from a four-year college. So, you know, seems like something's got to give, right? And obviously, with as engaging as video games are, it makes sense that we might think about how could we apply some of that engagement to school and learning. And one of the reasons I think that part of what makes it hard for students to be motivated about what they learn in school is that a lot of times what's taught is taught out of context. So they're sort of abstract ideas that aren't applied in any real way. And it's actually been shown that it's harder to learn material that way than when it's applied in an actual real-world situation. And so, you know, trigonometry becomes a lot more interesting when you're trying to build a bridge, right? And you, there's a reason to know the sine and cosine. And I work with a professor who's in computer graphics named Don Fassell. And, well, he's in computer science, excuse me. He teaches computer graphics, and meaning not visual design, but how to make a computer draw stuff on a screen. And in doing that, you have to use linear algebra. And so he's got students in his class that have taken a linear algebra class before. But they tell him that they did not understand linear algebra at all until they took his class and had a reason to see how it works. And so doing that made them understand it for the first time. So if they're designed well, where the material that needs to be learned is part of the mechanics of the game, and I think we've seen a lot of sort of disappointing educational games where that's not the case, then I think that, you know, it's possible that video games could be learned, could be used to help people learn the material in college curriculums in an applied, real-world situation sort of way. And I think one of the only things that is standing in the way of that is sort of attitudes. And, you know, basically the structure of universities and their teaching methods hasn't really changed since medieval times or so when universities started. And so I think it's going to take probably people, more and more professors who are gamers themselves, sort of reaching a critical mass in university to see that tide change. Mike?
How can I possibly follow that? You didn't use my linear algebra example. I was like, well, shoot, oh, what the hell am I going to say? All right, let's see if I can pull this. So games, in my opinion, are a new medium. Interactive simulation is a new medium. Just like, you know, books, the printed word at some point in time in our history was a new medium. Radio was a new medium. Television was a new medium. Now they're not so new, and we have a pretty good idea of how we can use them, both for entertainment and for more important purposes. So games are definitely a new medium. And so the question becomes, you know, really in my mind, not you know, can we use them for learning? It's absolutely possible to use them for learning. But what mechanisms are we going to create by which we maximize the potential of this learning? I imagine everybody in this room can think back to their grade school years and point to a particular teacher that transformed their lives. You know, I can certainly do that. It was Mrs. Connolly, my geometry teacher, who could somehow bounce a piece of chalk off the floor and hit that trash can every single time. And that's not the only thing I remember from her. I remember a mnemonic, you know, Sakatoa, that to this day helps me remember how to calculate the sine, cosine, and tangent of an angle. Okay? She taught me that. And I don't know if a game could teach me that in that exact same way. All right, now let's sort of turn this on our head for a minute. You know, as As I was introduced, I'm a commercial game developer. I used to be a programmer, and now I'm a production management consultant, which basically means the programmers kicked me out because they didn't want me coding anymore, and so I had to find something else to do. You know, one of the games I worked on was the Ultima series, and for those of you who have played that, you'll remember that the Ultima series was a fantasy role-playing game, not unlike, you know, Dungeon, you know, it's the computer expression of Dungeons and Dragons, you know, created by Gary Gygax, who unfortunately passed away this last week. You know, we can all, you know, take a moment and think about how he changed the world and what he taught us. But Ultima, one of the most transformational things Ultima did in Ultima 4 was to win the game, you had to become a good guy. It wasn't just about running around the world pillaging and stealing and killing everybody that you could see. It was about doing good things. The game actually measured how often you gave to the poor, how often you gave blood, sacrificed yourself, how often that when your enemy was in retreat, you let them run away in order to fight another day. And as I played this game when I was in high school, I recognized how this game actually changed my behavior in the real world. And that's something truly unusual. For those of you who have kids, you know, probably in elementary school or middle school, playing Guitar Hero for the first time, they now have an appreciation for classic rock and roll, and now they have a connection to you. So, of course, games can teach. Question becomes, in our minds, how can we do that, and what lessons can they teach? And can they teach some lessons better than the existing media we have? You know, everybody knows that radio is still alive and well. It wasn't replaced by television. In my opinion, college is going to be around for a long time. And I think if they're lucky and they do it correctly, they'll incorporate games, but it will never replace that situation.
Let me pose a couple questions here. Aliza, you mentioned this. Change on the part of faculty. How are faculty going to react if you go to them and say, you know what, you're not as important as you think you are?
How would anyone react to that?
In fact, I would argue it goes back even further than medieval times to the Greco-Roman model of, you know, the fount of learning, and everyone comes to, you know, to receive their learning from Socrates or Aristotle or whoever was the philosopher at that point. We're talking about within games and whether we do it for all courses or we do it just for a portion of the courses that match. And I'll get back to that in a minute because I think that's interesting, Mike. But at some point, the learning is going on among the players in the game, not with the faculty member dispensing knowledge. How are they going to react to that?
As far as I can tell, not that well, because that's not the paradigm that universities are set up on right now. But I think that change is coming, whether they like it or not. And I looked at a learning theory that is fairly recent that George Siemens developed called connectivism. And it's, you know, it's pretty self-evident, it sort of seemed, in that it acknowledged that knowledge in our day and age is a lot less about what we can personally hold in our heads and a lot more about who we know and the techniques that we have for finding information. And so that sort of approach, I think, can inform teaching and the way that faculty sort of help students learn. Because essentially, I think what a faculty member or teacher's role these days is more about facilitating learning among their students, helping students understand the processes that they need in order to grow their understanding, both of themselves and of the world, and how to do it in the kind of environment that we have today on the web, which is obviously far different than a world that where all the knowledge is either in people's heads or in books.
So. Okay. Karen, question for you. When I got a Facebook account, my daughter said, "Dad, that's just really creepy." What's going to be your reaction if the faculty members that have been your teachers suddenly start talking in game lingo? They suddenly start, you know, letting you play games as opposed to lecturing to you. You know, is it going to be creepy?
I don't think it'll be creepy. I think it would be, I'd be shocked at first thinking, are they really trying to incorporate something fun into the curriculum? But I think that, like, people that are, like, skeptical about video games working for education, I think that it would still spike an interest in them, and they would, in the back of their mind, and they would definitely want to, like, look into it. So
we might be able to get your interest, at least, if we had the game. So yeah. Now we've got to develop good games. And Mike, I wanted to ask you this, because you were telling a story a moment ago that I thought was fascinating. Typing of the Dead?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when we were in the panel room.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so how many people out there happen to own a Sega Dreamcast? Oh, few and proud. Anyway, so there was an arcade game. What was it? It was Night of the Dead or Night of the Living Dead or something like that. House of the Dead.
House of the Dead.
Sorry.
Oh, yes.
You know, I've slept since I've played it. So House of the Dead, it was a classic game. You know, you go up to Austin Park and Pizza. I still think they have, an installation of this game where, you know, you and a buddy are standing in front of this great big screen. You have guns and you shoot zombies as they come try to get you. All right. So that's the classic version of this game. Well, Sega, some brilliant person at Sega, decided that maybe they could use this game for a different purpose, and they created something called Typing of the Dead. Okay, so gun goes away, keyboard is in front of you. Zombie comes up, he stops moments before he gets to you, and a strange sequence of characters appears over his head. You then must type before the zombie gets you. And trust me, you learn how to type pretty fast under that game. And so what's interesting about this particular situation is, you know, it puts something into a fun, engaging environment that may be quirky, you know, but it's not stupid or annoying. It actually functions as a learning piece. And I think that's where a lot of mistakes are made in educational software development, where they try to take a very round peg and slam it through a square hole with a large sledgehammer, and students are smart enough to realize this is happening, and they go, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen, and then you've just wasted an awful lot of time and energy.
Yeah. Very good. And Aliza, I was going to follow up with you on that, because that's something you and I have talked about. Most serious games out there are really boring. They don't teach the content correctly, and they're not even fun to play. What are some of the elements that can make them fun that you've built into some of the serious games that you've developed?
Well, that's an interesting challenge in that I can't say that all of the games that, or you know, the few games that I've worked on, I would consider a success in that way. I think that it's actually pretty hard to do. But in some ways, I think we succeeded. And in doing that, what we've tried to do is made the mechanics of the game reflect what we're hoping that students are going to learn by playing it. And so rather than, jumpstart fifth grade, where you, like, shoot all the spiders in the spider web and then stop to answer a math question and then get 10 points, instead, you are sort of interacting with the elements of the game, and in doing that, learning a process. And in the case of the Army Medics, we were sort of simulating a command center where battle commanders would have to sort of learn, get information from their staff. And so that was how you played the game, was by interacting with the staff. Asking them sort of questions, or getting information from them, and then making decisions based on that. And so that's part of what we were trying to impart was, you know, what is the process by which, as a battle commander, you would be determining this information and then turning that into a plan.
That's sort of interesting, because both of you were talking then about teaching a process, teaching typing or skill and a process in terms of making those decisions. And that seems like a fairly wise thing to concentrate on within the serious game development, because if we've got the content available, as Mike was talking about, we've got content access out there in Wikipedia, in Google, then what we ought to be teaching is the process of evaluating that content and retrieving that content and using it, not necessarily the content itself. That's a good point. Karen, I had a question for you, because Elisa brought this up about, you know, the winning. You get to, you know, you shoot the spider and then you get to answer a question. If we were to build an online game, what kind of bribes would I have to offer you for you to want to play that game, for you to find it as addicting as you did with Halo 2, that you would, you know, maybe not sacrifice, but at least not compete on the level that you wanted to within your tennis tournament? Is, you know, do we need to give you iTunes for free? Do we, you know, or is it just the game itself, the ability to compete there and you know, master the game? What motivates you to spend until 4 o'clock in the morning playing Halo 2?
I think that just like the different, like how it's so different, I think that it would bring in a lot of kids to want to just try it out just to see what it's like, since it'll give you the opportunity to keep trying even if you like lose the first time, as opposed to school where if you do bad in one thing, it's kind of like you're just going to keep missing it later because school is so fast paced and you can't go back and learn it. Because I know that I took freshman biology and I missed a couple things, but teacher didn't have enough time to go back and help me. But so I'm taking like advanced placement biology now and I'm still missing the same thing because I just don't have time to go back and learn it. And so I think that games will give you an opportunity to keep trying and keep learning as opposed to just not knowing something.
Yeah. Mike, do you want to talk about from the commercial game side, that idea? Because that's always sort of intrigued me about video games is they don't punish you for failing. In fact, you are expected
Ultima sure
to
did.
Fail.
That's why we stopped.
But if you lose it in a video game, you know, that's one of the cool things about it. You die, you can always come back to life. But if you fail, you get another chance, and that basically is how you're learning.
Sure. I was listening to you ask Karen the question about, you know, how do we motivate players? And, you know, if there was a secret answer for that, I'd be the richest person on the planet. Okay. And so there is no real secret answer. It's kind of like, hey, let's create the next greatest toy for kids for this Christmas. Well, somebody's going to do it, but it's probably not you. Right. It's just not because you're not smart. It's just you didn't get lucky. But games, you know, there's a really interesting study that has been performed ongoing by our industry. And that has to do with things like player direction and ramping up of challenge. Because what you want people to do is you want people to be operating just outside their envelope of comfort, because that's how you get better at everything. You know, you can watch a master, you know, the classic mentorship programs where, you know, you intern with somebody who's really good at what they do. They challenge you constantly and stretch your skills, and you do fail from time to time. But sometimes you succeed, and the more you succeed, the better you get. And it's that perfect balance, I think, that makes a game fun. You want to feel like it's just beyond your skill, but you see the fact that you can make it. Other games, very punishing games, like I actually played a game with the Frag Dolls on Sunday. This wasn't my idea. A friend of mine said that he signed me up with the Frag Dolls downstairs. They're playing, you know, games against, you know, all comers, and they're beating them horribly. And they said that they were playing me against Guitar Hero, and I said, "Bring it on, I'm there." Unfortunately, when I walked up to the kiosk, they were still playing Rainbow Six, a game that I had never ever played in my life, and of course, I lost horribly. So this did not and motivate me to try this game again, okay? You know, but had we played something that I almost won, I would have rechallenged them. So I think there's a certain measure of that. Now, taking that to the classroom, right? And I think one of the problems with larger classrooms, and we all know that this is a big issue in our society today because we have too many students and not enough teachers. The problem is that not everybody learns at the same pace. the class is going to be too challenging for some and not challenging enough for others. And so the only kids that you get motivated is this thin slice of whoever is in the middle. That's why I think fundamentally our education system fails, is because we don't have the perfect level of challenge and motivation and direction for all levels of students. You know, we try our best, but unfortunately, that's where the classroom fails. Now, you know, I'm going to turn this on its head a bit and say that's where a game can help, because games can detect a person's skill actually fairly easily and adjust its level of difficulty to match more closely with the player. So that's something that is possible.
It's a great point. In fact, we talk about in the online course area, we talk about distance learning. And I would probably argue that sitting at the back of a 500 student classroom with the stage down there is probably, that's really distance learning. You're a long ways away. But that's a very good point. Aliza, at the same time, the large classrooms that we see at, and not just at UT Austin, at every large state school, they're there for the sake of efficiency and scale. We don't have enough instructors to teach in that ideal small environment of 5 or 7 kids. We have to go to 500, and if we look at needing to bring education out to the world, we're looking at thousands of students in classes. How do you reconcile that? How do you reconcile, you know, the need for the interaction that you get in the small classes and the distance that you get in the large classes, and can games address that particular issue?
I hope so. I hope so. I think that's potentially a huge advantage of games, is their ability to scale and their ability to, in that sort of, you know, Halo multiplayer kind of context, to not have to scale on the scope of 500 students to one teacher, but instead allow sort of small group interaction with a number of instances of a game. And so I think that's sort of a fascinating aspect even of multiplayer games today, that you know that there are thousands, if not millions, of people within the world, but you can go into an area and just interact with a small group of people. And I think in that sense, and ideally, let's say the massively multiplayer game for NASA that I was talking about earlier would use techniques like that for sort of small group learning and also peer mentoring, as it's called, so that people can help each other out, help each other learn. Students are also really motivated by that, by teaching other students. And so I think games really do have the capacity to address some of those issues. Okay. I think one of the challenges, though, and I don't know if you're going to bring this up later, Michael, but is the assessment, as it's called, of learning. And that's a big part of school. And it's a big part of instruction or teaching in general, is how do you know that the students that you've taught have learned anything? And the whole sort of No Child Left Behind movement was in a large sense about that, about accountability. And, you know, how do we know that our kids are learning? And video games, of course, address that handily by assessing players constantly as they play the game. But in that case, what they're assessed on is boiled down often to some pretty simple behaviors within the game. And that might be more akin to, let's say, a multiple choice test in a classroom. And so it's still out there, I think, as a challenge to be able to develop assessments within interactive games that are more sort of nuanced and more subtle, maybe more complex and rich than what games do today. And I think also in the sense of, let's say, using commercial video games in classrooms, which is also a very viable possibility, I found some interesting things when I talked to middle school students who play games and asked them, you know, so do you learn anything by playing the games that you play? I thought they did. I knew they did. But in their minds, they were like, well, yeah, I can play the game better. I can race better. You know, that's, and they, in their minds, weren't seeing this sort of underlying sort of skills that they might have been picking up and learning in the game. And so I think that's another aspect of our challenge is that when you teach someone, you want them to know that they learned it, right? I mean, we want, after we get our college degree, we tend to think we know some stuff. And you know, if we got that degree and we're like, I learned how to go to school better, we probably wouldn't have succeeded.
See, I'll take a little bit devil's advocate point here. I think that if, you know, a student came out of college and they were able to perform and they were able to use the material that was learned in there, even if they kind of got it without realizing that they got it, I think that would be okay. You know, I'm not sure that the, you know, thinking that, oh, I've got my degree and now I know something out there. When I got out and I got my degree and I thought I knew something, it only took about a year at News Corp for me to realize I didn't know anything. They were very quick to point that out.
Intrinsically, I would say, you know, Mark Twain said, don't let school get in the way of your education.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
You know,
exactly.
I basically agree with you.
Exactly. Mike, I wanted to ask you a point because we had a discussion about this at one point too. Talk a little bit about the practical aspects, because the kind of games that we're talking about are not cheap to develop. You look at, you know, something like Halo 3, and you're talking tens of millions of dollars in terms of the development out there. And I can sit here on a real, you know, kind of theoretical level and say, wow, we should all develop these really cool immersive games and, you know, that are really going to addict students to learning. And yet from a practical level, just designing, as you said the other day, a can that goes in a game may take an entire day.
That's right, it does. So, yeah, let's. I think that's a really critical key component of what we're talking about, because, you know, we do have finite resources on the planet Earth, right? And developing a game is a horrifically expensive process. You know, we're still kind of pre-industrial revolution here in game industry. We're having artisans lovingly craft every object in the game, like this bottle, right? I mean, this takes, you know, this bottle probably costs $5,000 to create in an interactive game, okay? An unbelievable amount of money and time. So I actually had a client a couple of years ago who wanted to develop a serious game. And, you know, I won't tell you exactly what it was, but as they were describing the project to me, I kept thinking, you could do this with a book. This is just me reading. I could read this in a book and learn it exactly as well as you paying me. At the time, I think we were going to charge them $1.5 million for the development of this thing. A book does not cost that much, okay? Believe me, I wrote one. It didn't cost that much, and it doesn't make that much either. But it is effective at what it does. So, okay, let's look at another totally separate problem that I can talk a little bit about with more detail. The only serious game that I ever really had an opportunity to work on was a game for the U.S. Navy called 24 Blue. This particular game was a simulation of the deck of a working aircraft carrier. And as a part of this game, we actually, as part of research, the Navy actually flew us out to the USS Truman, wandering around somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean. And me and my team actually got to land on the carrier, spend 4 days there, walk around on deck during flight operations, which I will tell you is the most terrifying thing you have ever imagined. The Discovery Channel does not do this thing justice, okay? You know, when you can feel the heat of the jet blast of an F-14 Tomcat on your face as you're being pulled to the deck by somebody else who is saving your life at that very moment, that's when it hits reality. Okay. So in that story, what you could tell from that is why we were developing the game we were developing. Our job was to make sure that the deck crew, the people in all the colored shirts that you're so familiar with seeing on the Discovery Channel, we were developing a game for them so that they could understand where things were on the deck, where the human beings were, how the aircraft moved, the physical size and structure of the space, the hand signals that they used to direct aircraft around, okay? Because you can't hear out there, okay? You know, and so all of these things were critically important to human life and valuable assets of our military. So the question is, can that game replace training of actually being there on that deck? No, it cannot. Absolutely. It will never truly replace it because believe me, when you're there, it's a totally different thing. But what it can do is it can show you more about what's going on there so that when you're actually there, your brain isn't going to be as frazzled, addled, and crazed as mine was. I was barely human on that deck because I was so terrified. Had I used this training simulation before, I would have known what to expect. And the training I would have received during those few short hours I would have had there would have been more quality and would have perhaps kept me from making huge mistakes, which would have cost human lives and assets. So that's what games in this particular case are good for, right? It's what is the risk of failure, right? And of course, flight simulations have been used like this forever. The risk of failure is death to you and everybody else around you. So, you know, that's why you want to spend that kind of money and create a game to do something of that nature.
You bring up a great point. Lisa, there's a difference here, and Mike's drawn it pretty clearly, between games and simulations. How do you think they differ? Are serious games more like simulations, or is that how they have been deployed in the past, and you see that as their most effective deployment in the future? Or, you know, can we take a lot of the simulations and take them to the next level to actually move them into a game-like environment? Or should they stay as simulations?
Let's see, to start with, I think, what was the first question? A lot of people have talked about the difference between simulations and games, and that games basically have a rule set that has what are called victory conditions. So there is a way to win. And normally with simulations, it's set up as more of what Will Wright called SimCity, which is a toy in a sense. It's a set of processes that you can interact with. And of course, there's a rule set behind those processes. But there usually isn't a way to necessarily win that simulation. And of course, games can have aspects of simulation in them, and you can take simulations and make them into games. So I don't think it's easy to, you know, draw those sorts of lines that, you know, all serious games should be simulations or anything like that. I think in every case, it depends on what you're trying to do and what you're trying, in the case of educational games or games for learning, to teach. And so I think in a lot of cases, simulation kinds of interactive applications can work really well for teaching people. And online, I've found lots and lots of instances of teachers using SimCity in their classrooms to help teach about what it's like to run a city. And so I think it makes a lot of sense. In a way, all games are sort of, now it depends how complex the game itself is, but games can be fairly complex systems. And so simulations often just make that complexity a little bit more transparent and sort of available for understanding by the user. And so I think simulations can help people or learners understand better complex systems like running a city.
Thanks. Karen, I'm going to put you on the spot here. Sorry. Let's talk about cheating. When you're working on your homework at night, do you ever have multiple IM windows open where you're working on homework, a couple of different kinds of homework?
Definitely. Like, I'll talk on the phone or I'll text someone and ask them.
Yeah. Do you consider that cheating? You're getting help from somebody. You're not studying it on your own, and you're having to learn it by yourself the way your instructor viewed it. Do you consider that cheating to get that additional help?
Definitely not.
Okay. Aliza, do faculty members, would they, at the university level at least, and I know Karen's in high school, but we can extrapolate here, would instructors at the university level consider that any type of academic dishonesty to receive help from a group of students within the class?
Not as far as I can tell, really. I think mostly group learning, small group learning is, at least from what I hear from the students that I work with, mm-hmm. is pretty well accepted. And students learning in team and doing team-based projects in class is pretty common,
okay.
as I understand it.
Okay, so we've gotten over one hurdle there. Mike, talk about this, if you would, for a moment. I thought you made a really great point that some things can be done in a game and some things can be, may not be appropriate at all. And I thought you made a very good distinction between that games are a new medium. When radio first came up and it was running out there and then TV developed, the first TV shows, they just sat there and talked just like they were on the radio.
That's right.
So it took a while for TV to realize what its medium was and that it was, as McLuhan said, a hotter medium because you had the visual component. And I think games are in the same area, if you look at it as a medium, that they're still finding their way. So what do you see as things that can, you talked about processes, we talked about simulations, but what are things that games should not try to do out there? What are the things we ought to stay away from?
Oh, boy. It's kind of funny. I think that's an incredibly difficult question to answer because, maybe one way I could rephrase that, perhaps just a tiny bit, is what can games not teach right now?
Good enough.
Okay. I happen to be, just a little background, I happen to be at the Computer Game Developers Conference just a few weeks ago, where one of the keynote speakers was Ray Kurzweil, futurist. Fantastic session, and he was looking towards the future, and actually, it's hardly even the future now. He predicted in just, a few decades, we will actually be at the point where, we're not even going to be sitting in front of a computer interacting with hardware anymore. We're just going to jack in, and it's just going to be, just like Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash. We'll just be, wandering around this virtual world, literally being able to experience anything we want, and feeling and having it react in as perfect a way as the programmers could imagine. So, at that point, I think it still becomes a matter of has the simulation industry or games industry, have we proceeded to the point where we're past the Industrial Revolution, and it doesn't take, hours, it takes nanoseconds to create this, right? Where I can just point a camera at it, scan it, and it understands its properties perfectly well. I don't have to have a computer game designer key all that in. It knows its weight. It knows that this is glass. It even knows that there's, Topo Chico in here, right? So at that point, I think that the question that you ask becomes a lot more cloudy. Mm-hmm. Then it becomes, the answer may be that particular environment can teach things better than we can learn them in real life because it allows us to fail without horrific consequences. Mm-hmm. Now, in today's world, the only way we can, we interact with a simulation through a very, very small, narrow bandwidth interface. Guitar Hero, it's a guitar with one string and five frets. Am I going to learn how to play guitar with that? Probably not, okay? But it does teach me something about the music, so, it is possible it can teach us something like that. There is a project, many projects that I know of that are trying to teach, like the Pulse project being developed by University of Texas A&M at Corpus Christi. They're trying to teach medical students surgical techniques with the computer, right? Now, personally, I haven't interacted with this particular simulation, so I can't really judge whether or not this is going to work well or not. But I imagine that the entire spectrum of everything you need to know in order to be a surgeon can't be taught because the interface just isn't there yet, right? We interact with it you know, with a mouse and a keyboard or maybe a dual stick controller, which again is a very narrow bandwidth interface, you know. But it still can show me things that I perhaps wouldn't learn with a cadaver, perhaps, you know, because I'm interacting with a simulation of a living organism. So good question. You know, I think that it has to do with the bandwidth of the interface that you're dealing with.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I don't think I would really want to be operated on by somebody who just gone through an online
right on.
At the same time, in the Screen Burn Arcade, I did see the new it plugs into Guitar Hero. It's an actual guitar, and it looks and feels like a real guitar. That's getting closer there. Okay. We're going to have to kind of pause here for a minute, if it's okay, because we're getting short on time. I would like to open up to questions from the audience. And there's a mic there if you want to use that, or if you just want to shout it out, I'll be glad to repeat it so that everybody can hear.
Hi there. My name is Ken Eklund. And my question has to do with alternate reality games. Are the panelists familiar? Because it just seems to me that alternate reality games are much more, they're inexpensive and they're much more kind of reaching to where we are now. It seems like getting, Halo 3 in the classroom is, that's threatening to teachers. But with an alternate reality game, it's much more like the teacher, that's a tool that the teacher actually uses and participates in.
Yeah. That's a good question.
I think classroom-based games that aren't digital at all are a great option for teachers. I think some of the same barriers that might keep teachers from using a digital game might also keep them from playing any kind of game in the classroom if it's not a barrier that has to do with technology. But I would think alternate reality games have potential. They still require quite a bit of careful design. So, there's still the overhead of that. I would think depends on what you were trying to teach through an alternate reality game. But I think the potential to engage students with, a real world sort of, imagined situation is great.
If you could just define an alternate reality game, I'm sure it's a concept which is not known to everyone in the room.
Oh, well, do you want to? Feel free.
Sure. Very quickly, an alternate reality game is kind of perhaps the exact opposite of something like Second Life. Instead of having a virtual world that you operate in, you're operating in the real world. You can also think of it as kind of the difference. It's different from role-playing. In role-playing, you take on some sort of avatar, you are some sort of alternate persona, whereas in an alternate reality game, you play yourself, so there's no role-playing, it's situation playing. The situation is different. There's it's also kind of called an augmented reality game because the world is a little bit different. It's kind of like, in some ways, acting in a spy novel or something like that. So Wikipedia has a really good definition. So.
Cool. Thanks.
I just wanted to say that I went to a magnet boarding school in Alabama, not a state really known for making education a priority, and it was an incredible experience. It was a wonderful school, and the state put aside the resources necessary to give me an incredible opportunity with incredible teachers. So I think the issue of where we put our resources is really important. And yes. not one of those teachers used a video game in class. I didn't learn by, playing games. I learned because, for example, I had an English teacher who, when we had to read Graham Greene's The Heart of the Matter, said for your final essay, in the voice of God, form a persuasive argument as to whether or not the lead character deserves to go to heaven or hell based on his actions in the book. So I think if we say, something like dropout rates are up or these schools are really disappointing us, we have to be careful about citing that as any sort of reason to bring games into the classroom, because it's really important that we also respect the great teachers we have in this country who are just doing amazing, innovative assignments with little more than words and ideas and a chalkboard and some dusty books they never open. And those people, you know, our hat should be off of them, and we should really ask, should we spend $10 million developing a game to help them do their jobs better, or should we offer them all, or 10,000 of them, an extra $1,000 for, you know, a job well done?
Yeah. Amen,
and
brother.
Yeah. Could not agree more. Yeah. And I don't think video games will ever replace teachers.
Right.
By
I mean,
the way.
I know that you guys don't that you don't disagree with anything I'm saying, yeah. And that it's good to do extreme sides of the argument. But I just, whenever I hear these panels, I always want to say, you know, please make teachers feel loved, because there are a lot of really great teachers who do a great job with what they've got.
Absolutely, I'd agree with you. My wife is a teacher special ed in the middle school, and when I've had this discussion with her, that is the exact point she makes, and I agree with her 100%. The only issue that I have is looking out a few years when we have more knowledge and more ways of learning things and more people, and not just within this country, but, you know, I think our responsibility to educate extends way beyond our borders. And could we maybe spend less on bombing places and more on teachers? I think that's probably a good idea.
What an idea.
And I'd say the educational system probably needs more help than teachers do. Teachers are awesome.
Hi, I'm Andy Carvin. I do the Learning Now blog for PBS. You've talked a lot today about creating games and sims and then bringing them into the classroom, but I haven't really heard much about giving students the construction tools to create their own games and sims. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit about what you think the state of the art is in that area right now and what potential it might have.
Yeah, actually, there was a really fantastic announcement by Microsoft just a few weeks ago. For a couple of years, they've had a technology called XNA Game Studio, which allowed students, anybody, you know, me, right, to create games for Windows PC and Xbox 360. Well, what's really cool about the announcement that they made a couple of weeks ago is that not only can anyone create a game using that technology, but they can now distribute it over Xbox Live. So, you know, now we have what Microsoft called the democratization of distribution. You know, it wasn't just democratization of creation, but now distribution. And so now anybody who has a story to tell or something they want to teach can do that with a PC or Xbox 360. And personally, I think it's going to completely change the computer games industry as we know it. Now we don't, we're kind of on the same playing field with a bunch of very creative people who don't need a lot of money to create these things.
And if I could follow that up, do you see kids or young people doing that outside of the classroom, or do you think there will be teachers out there who may actually want to introduce that as part of their lessons plans where they're actually in the classroom doing that?
I wouldn't be surprised to see sort of keystone projects, you know, because they are still, you know, a fair amount of work. You know, they're not something you just go home on the weekend and throw together. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see that in some certain classrooms, you know, especially, you know, say a physics class or chemistry class or something like that, that has that sort of obvious, you know, line drawn to it quickly. But soon, I think we're going to see a whole lot more than just the obvious, because some of the games that I saw at GDC a couple of weeks ago were absolutely stunningly cool. And, you know, I just like, okay, here's the new world, and I'm watching the door open, and I'm standing right here, and it was just amazing. So, yeah, everybody should get an Xbox 360 and watch Xbox Live, because you're going to see some really neat stuff. Yeah.
And it's an outgrowth of the modding that you see in a lot of games out there. I mean, you've never played Counter-Strike until you've actually fought with a fish. Aliza, you had something else
those
to say?
Those mods are awesome. I was just also going to say that if you don't have an Xbox 360, that Garage Games also puts out a commercially available engine that the undergrads in our lab used to create a game, and it's only about $100, so it's really affordable for students to be able to use and create games that run on PCs.
Thanks.
Do we get time for one more question? One more question, sorry. But only one of us gets to answer.
I'll make it quick. I'm Ashley Reardon, and I'm an instructional designer, and I totally believe in learning by doing, anything that gets us closer to experiential learning. I don't think it should replace the entire college education system. And what I'm wondering is, you know, I think about mediums, I've watched movies or read books like the Da Vinci Code. incredibly engaging, really got me hooked on the topic. And I know there was a lot of fiction, but there was also some nonfiction components that led me to want to research further. So I wonder, actually, if instead of jumping both feet into this, could we not consider a model where games and education become that hook, that engagement that draws students into that experience, and then we follow on with some of our more traditional or collaborative techniques to keep them learning further?
I think that's a great idea. Use it as a hook in there. Thank you very much. We appreciate your attendance this morning and hope you've enjoyed the discussion. We have a long ways to go, but I do believe in the power of video games, and I hope you do too.